Okay, as I mentioned, we are beginning a study in the book of Hebrews today. And as we begin this, before we actually start looking at text, we need to look at some background stuff. But let me begin by asking you, whenever you're studying a book of the Bible, what's one of the most important things to understand in terms of studying the Bible? Any particular book? Anybody have any idea?
Yeah, who's the audience?
Okay.
And look at the author, who's the audience, that particular moment in time, if you will.
Okay.
And also the circumstances. What motivated it? Is there issues, or is there guidance that's being shared, or is it a message that's being passed along to other countries? So you got to think of the
background,
the whole,
yeah,
what's going on, why was it initiated, and who's the audience, and et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. Basically, we kind of put all that under the umbrella of context, okay? What is the context under which this that it was written? The reason that's so important is because it helps understand two things. Number one, why was that particular letter or book or whatever it is relevant to the people that it was actually written to, okay, in the first century? What purpose did it serve, and so on? But then also, then what relevance does it have for us today? What application does it have for us today? Or does it have any for us today? Okay? So when we understand some of those background things, which a lot of people, when you start talking about background, go, oh, you got to go through, you know. It's really important to get a handle on some of those factors so that we have a better understanding of the text in terms of its purpose and so forth, but also its application to us today. So, first of all, when it comes to Hebrews, let's talk about the authorship. Okay? Now, nobody is indicated in the book of Hebrews as to being claiming authorship. So therefore, the authorship is somewhat questionable. All right? I underline the word somewhat. Okay? For roughly about 1,200 years, the Apostle Paul is the one who the book has been accredited to as being the author. There's a lot of reasons for that. But mostly that he was the earliest accepted author of it. The letter indicates, first of all, there's a good knowledge not only of the Old Testament and all things Old Testament that it talks about, but also of New Testament Greek. The Greek of that particular time is very good. So the person was likely a learned person, but also likely was someone that was well known by the audience that it was written to. Okay? So Paul is a good candidate. The difficulty with Paul is that there are some differences in the book of Hebrews from the other letters that we know that Paul did write. And one of the primary differences is that he didn't name himself, which he does in the other letters, okay? So that's one of the things there that kind of causes a little bit of question, you know, did Paul really write this or was it someone else, okay? Another person who is a good candidate, okay, I'm still of the opinion that Paul is the author, okay? That's just my, you know, from my study and so forth. But another good candidate for the authorship is Barnabas. Okay? Barnabas had many of the very same qualities that Paul did. Okay? Well-educated. He was well-versed in the Old Testament law and the history of the Israelite people and all of those kind of things. Well-educated in terms of the language of the day, Greek, and so forth. There's another thing that's interesting about it that you know, again, which way you lean, and I don't know that it really makes a tremendous amount of difference, okay, in terms of the authenticity of the book, all right, whether it was Paul or perhaps Barnabas. One of the things that is said about it is that, and I already mentioned that he doesn't identify himself, but in chapter 2 in verse 3, okay, the author, whoever it is, tells us that this salvation, which was first announced by the Lord, was confirmed by those who heard him. Okay? And so this raises a question. If Paul were the author, then perhaps that statement would read differently. Though Paul did not directly hear Jesus, okay, in terms of while he was still here, but Paul did have a revelation from Jesus himself. Okay? But there was no indication that Barnabas ever did. Okay? And the reason that Barnabas is suggested is because Tertullian quotes from the epistle to the Hebrews under the name of Barnabas. Was one of the earliest suggestions of authorship. And that was back around 200 A.D. So, you know, just in terms of authorship, it's probably either Paul or Barnabas, okay? Those are the two likely candidates. Apollos is another one that is mentioned. Not a lot of strong evidence for him. It's likely either Paul or Barnabas. But again, the important thing when it comes to the authorship is understand that those two have been accepted in wide ranges as the author, and so the credibility of the book itself has not really in question at all. Okay, the authenticity of it and so forth. Does that make sense? All right. Okay, let's talk about in terms of who the recipients of this letter are. And by the way, it was probably written before 70 A.D., okay? And the reason that we say that is what happened in 70 A.D.? Destruction of Jerusalem. And the references that we find in Hebrews to the temple and things of that nature were written in the present tense, indicating that the temple had not been destroyed yet. Okay? Makes sense? So likely before 70 A.D. Now, the recipients of this letter, and this is really important in understanding, again, that background stuff in terms of how did they receive it, and then also for us today, the application of us today. The recipients were for the most part, Jewish Christians or Israelite converts to Christianity, all right? And the reason that that's, so significant in this is because the efforts and what the focus of Hebrews is primarily about is to try to keep Jewish Christians from leaving their Christianity and going back into Judaism. Or basically the idea of trying to be a Christian, but yet still impose much of the law of Moses on Christians, which is what was happening so much in the first century amongst Jewish converts to Christianity. That was a huge problem. And that's something that Paul dealt with constantly. Wherever he went, he was in, having confrontations with Jews, not only those who were not Christians, okay, who were opposed to Christianity altogether, but there was also a big segment of Jews who had converted to Christianity, but the struggle was, are we supposed to still keep the law of Moses? And you see Paul addressing a lot of those issues in several of his letters, okay? But that's the situation that we have is again, there's pressure from the Israelites that are not Jews for Christians to leave Christianity, come back to Judaism. But then there's also those who are Christians, those Israelites who have accepted Christ. There's that pressure that's coming and going, you know, maybe we should still keep this law and these sacrifices and, you know, and so on and so forth. So the author here is really focusing on that group of people, all right? Israelite Christians, people who know the law, people who are very familiar with the history of the Israelites, and we see that throughout this letter. That's why we know that, you know, that's really the audience. In other words, this book would not have done a tremendous amount of good at that particular time for what it was trying to do for those who were a Gentile audience, because they didn't really know a whole lot of the background of the Israelite people that the author writes about. Okay? So a lot of the things that are written here, the Gentiles would have gone, what's he talking about? Doesn't make any sense. They would not have been able to relate, in other words, to some of the arguments that he was making, you say, because they weren't familiar with the law or the history. Make sense? Everybody understand that? Any questions, comments, sing out. Kathy?
Well, wasn't he also trying to encourage the Christians to hang on, because after all this time, when the Lord said he was coming quickly, he hadn't come yet. And so Right. They were wondering, is it time? Is he ever going to come? Maybe we should go back. And then the persecution, because not Right. Shortly after, Jerusalem fell. So they had a lot of issues going on.
There was a lot going on. In fact, That's the other part of how we're going to study this book, okay? Brother Terry Bell has a book out called Reviving a Tired Church, and it's a study of Hebrews.
Oh, wow.
Okay? And the whole idea behind what he writes there is that exactly what you're saying, the church is tired, mm-hmm. Okay? There's been a lot of persecution. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of this stuff, as I mentioned a moment ago, going on. Wait a minute, you need to keep these laws. And so people are getting weary. The promise was the Lord was going to come back. Mm-hmm. He where is he? He's not here yet. Some of the questions that Paul specifically addressed in his first letter to the church in Corinth was about, you know, people who were Christians waiting for the Lord, but they had already died. And so, wait a minute, what's going to happen there? What about this resurrection thing? And people were confused about a lot of things. So it was a discouraging time to be a Christian. Okay? When these words were written. So yes, they were written to encourage Jewish Christians to maintain their faith and not go back into Judaism, not partake of the law and so forth, but also to not give up. But it's really a book in large part about renewal, revival, if you will. Okay, so as we go through this, we're going to be looking at some of those aspects of it. I actually have two different sets of notes, okay, that I put together for this. One of them is basically reviving a tired faith. And the other is just an outline, for the most part, of Hebrews. And so we're going to be kind of going back and forth between those, looking at all these different aspects of the book of Hebrews. All right? Any questions, thoughts there?
Ross, I think even among the disciples, there was still a lot the apostles, there was a lot of misconception sometimes with what do we take from the law and carry it into the Christianity.
Yeah. Faith. Probably by this time, we're talking about, you
hopefully
know,
they were
late in the first mm-hmm. century, you know, before 70 mm-hmm. AD, but probably at least amongst the apostles, mm-hmm. Much of that kind of thing had pretty well cleared up.
Okay.
But it still was a lot of confusion amongst others, you know, and so forth, in terms of what do we do with all of this.
But I guess the point I'm trying to make is if even apostles could get confused.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The everyday Christian would really have more problems with that.
Absolutely. And be really discouraged. Keep in mind this particular concept. And I don't know how many of you ever experienced this or not, okay? When you were converted, okay, to Christianity, what was your background before that religiously?
Yeah.
Okay? And so then, based on your background, how difficult was it to really let go of everything you've been taught and learned and knew and practiced all your life to now grasp a hold of these new concepts? You see? And that's basically what Jewish Christians were facing in this particular time period. They've been Jewish all their lives. And the law and the prophets was everything. Okay? And when somebody mentioned Abraham, immediately the thought was what? You mention Abraham's name. Abraham's our father. You mention Moses, then what? The lawgiver. Moses gave us the law, right? And you mentioned David, it's like what?
Our king.
He's our king. You put those three together, okay? This is the E.F. Hutton of the Old Testament. Have you heard me talk about before, right? Mm-hmm. You mention somebody's name and it's like, whoa. Those names were significant to the Israelite people. Always had been. Okay? So now, under Christ, those names historically are still important, right? But religiously, they don't really carry as much significance. Why?
Because they didn't die for the church.
Because what?
They didn't die for the church.
No, they didn't. And so Abraham, our father, is replaced by who? By God, the Father. Okay? Moses, the lawgiver, is replaced by Christ. You see? All right? And David, our king, is replaced by Christ, our king, right? So, again, just think of how difficult it would have been, to let go of all of those kinds of concepts and totally embrace this new teachings in the midst of, hey, if you don't deny this Jesus, we're going to throw you to the lions or whatever. Or, the Jews who were going, no, that's heresy. You need to come back to God and so on and so forth. A lot of pressure. Okay? I know for myself, and I've mentioned this before various times, I was a Catholic for 21 years of my life. Went to a seminary, studied to be a priest. Okay? And then God sent me this woman into my life. And all of those things, as Cindy and I sat and studied the Bible together, I'm looking at what the Bible says, which didn't really do a whole lot of studying in the Bible, believe it or not. You don't do that in Catholicism. And I'm reading it. I can see it for myself. But all of that history, all of that background is saying, no, this isn't right. You see. And so, if you have any kind of experience like that in your background, you have an idea of what some of these folks were experiencing. You see? The struggle to completely let go of everything and grasp onto this new, when that's been all you've known all your life. You see? All right? Any other comments, questions at all?
Well, I was kind
of... Go ahead. Go ahead, Judy.
Well, I was kind of thinking, it's what they learned with the law and all that. That was almost second nature to them. It was part of who they were. And now you expect for to be expected to let go of all of that, not just part of it, but all of it.
Right.
And look at salvation in a whole different picture.
Right.
And okay. That it had to be difficult.
All right, Chuck.
It's a transition. I reflect back on us being in the military, and those who came from the United States to Germany for the first time, or Korea, or any other foreign country for the first time. there was a program to help us integrate, help us understand, so that, hey, you're a guest here in this country.
Yeah. That's so you don't go around telling everybody, hey, I'm an American, right?
Mm-hmm. And yeah. All that.
Wrong thing to do.
I'm a son of Abraham.
Yeah.
See, they were much doing the same thing because they were going, hey, this is where we came from.
Right.
And that transition, they said, well, this is not where you're at.
Right.
This is, you know, that was that.
Past.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, I can relate. A lot of us can relate when we think about it that way, that when you go to a different country, all these different things that are happening. Now, you're telling me that Abraham is not relevant anymore. We can't put him on a pedestal.
Yeah.
That's correct. We can't put the temple on the pedestal. That's correct. Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Because now they come into a new way of life.
Yeah. You know? It's like, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. Things are going to be different from now on. Here's another really important aspect of this, okay, to keep in mind. And this has implications even for us today, okay, as we look at and study the book here. Under the Israelite system, at the time that, you know, we're looking at when Jesus came in the first century, Judaism, in terms of its practice, was primarily what? Anybody have an idea? How would you describe it? It was really, for the most part, it was ritualistic, if anything. Okay? The Israelite people, for the most part, as a whole, all right, really looked upon their relationship with God as being secure because of
rituals.
Not just the rituals, but we've already mentioned a couple of people here.
Because of the relationship with Abraham.
Yeah, because we're Abraham's children,
mm-hmm.
and so we are saved, okay? Which then means, we got Moses and the law, and the law says we got to do these sacrifices you mentioned, so we're doing those sacrifices, and we're saved because we have God, he's our God, and Abraham is our father, so everything's good, right? What did Jesus say about the Israelite peoples, particularly about the leadership? When he quoted from Isaiah, anybody remember? Well did Isaiah prophesy of these people, they honor me with their lips, but what?
Their hearts are far from me.
Their hearts are far from me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things about the book of Hebrews, okay, and this again is particularly applicable to us today, is, the reviving a tired church, it's the application saying, look, we cannot be content with just sitting around doing nothing. Christianity calls upon us to do what?
Action.
But what kind of action?
Serving the Lord.
How? Sacrifice. Be specific. You guys hear me talk about this all the time. Take up your cross and follow me. You see, you got to be willing to die for it. In other words, it requires more than just this acknowledgement in a sense that says, yes, we belong to God because Abraham is our father and we have the law of Moses. Christianity requires us to respond to God, and not just in some ritualistic sacrifices, you say, but rather, and Paul in Romans chapter 12 makes a huge contrast, doesn't he, when he tells us what kind of sacrifices are we supposed to be making? A living sacrifice, a sacrifice of our body as a living sacrifice, you see? So life as a Christian for these Christian Jews who had been so used to just kind of skating along because they belong to God is a challenge. It's a challenge. You mean I really have to do something? Yes. Now, I got you, Brian. Hold on just a second here. Why is that so significant for us today to keep in mind?
I think a lot of churches today are very ritualistic as well.
Okay.
And then you convert over into the Christ body, and it's not about rituals. It's about your self-sacrifice. And we tend to be a lazy people. We want to sit and hear, but when it comes to the doing, that's a whole different ball game.
Yeah, even within the Lord's church.
Exactly.
You know, as long as I go to worship service, you know, we don't even oftentimes call it that. I go to church.
Mm-hmm.
Check off my scorecard. You know, I'm okay. And so as we go through this letter, this book here, I want you to be looking for things that are really speaking to us. It spoke to them, okay, but are speaking to us today to say, wake up, okay? Wake up and start paying attention to what God has said. Brian?
Well, I was going to say with that, you look at the back before Christ came. You just talked about how they felt comfortable. They were able to do these burnt sacrifice, and they were good and all that. And then Christ came, and he died on the cross, and it energized the church. So Satan goes after persecution and by death, and he found out that fires them up more. Now, you look at us today, he's learned and saying, I need to go make them feel comfortable again.
Yep.
Our persecution, our discouragement is the exact same position that they're in back then. We look around at our church today, and we go, how are we going to keep going?
Yeah.
I passed the church at Destination Church. They have 4 worship services this morning, and it's packed full of movie theater, and they all feel comfortable about themselves, and they all go about living their daily lives. And Satan's picked up on it and saying, all I got to do is make them feel comfortable that they're saved.
Yep.
That it doesn't require sacrifice.
Right.
It doesn't require this. Just do a little of this and a little of this, and God's not going to condemn me because I'm doing this every week.
Why? Because
so Satan's learned that all he's got to do is go back to where he was successful before. Make us feel comfortable.
Feel comfortable,
even
we come
in
back
the
to
church.
Days. Yeah.
Look at who's here now and who will be here later. Look at the church before or after the pandemic. Oh, I'm comfortable just watching, you know, I don't mean to offend anybody, but I'm comfortable just watching on video and not show up to church. He wants us to be comfortable. He doesn't want it to be a sacrifice anymore.
And I've said this before, and I think it's exactly right. Satan really doesn't care whether we go to church or not, okay? As long as we don't start doing what Jesus tells us to do. You see, that's what bothers him. So he doesn't care whether the churches are full or not. Go to church all you want to, just don't start doing what God tells you to do, okay?
Day to day.
Yeah. Okay, so let's begin in the text here, okay? And let's notice the very first contrast, and this is one of the things we're going to see throughout the book here, is a lot of contrast being made between the way things were versus the way things are now. Were, okay, under the Old Testament, under Abraham, under Moses, you know, and so forth, versus are under Christ, right? So he begins talking about the way things were in the past in terms of God just simply communicating with his people. All right? And so he starts out by saying, in the past, God did what?
spoke to our ancestors through the prophets.
Okay, he spoke to our ancestors, okay, or our fathers, depending on our forefathers, depending on what translation you have. And he says he did that through the prophets, and then he did it specifically how? At many times and in various ways. Right? Which indicates that, you know, God wasn't limited in the way that he communicated with his people. All right? So, what are some of the examples off the top of your head where God spoke to his people through the prophets in many ways and many times?
Raising up judges.
I'm sorry?
Judges.
Judges, okay.
He spoke to the patriarchs.
Okay, he spoke directly to the patriarchs, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He dealt with Abraham mano a mano, right? Face to face, one on one. Here we are.
In dreams.
Okay, and do what?
In dreams.
In dreams, okay. How else?
Through messengers.
Through messengers, specifically what kinds?
Angels.
Angels.
Samuel.
Okay.
Okay. Him to speak to the people when he finally decided to do it.
Okay, he used a fish that time, didn't he, to speak to him, right?
Sure,
okay. What about a donkey?
Yeah, donkey.
You know, I mean, again, the writer here, you know, tells me he did it many times. In other words, it wasn't just one revelation that he gave. He did it lots of times. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of examples of instances where God communicated with his people. And he did it in a lot of interesting ways.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
On top of a mountain, right?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, that scared him silly.
It scared the Israelites so much, they said, no, you go. We're not going to go up there.
They didn't hear him.
You see?
Mm-hmm.
So that's how God, the writer says, in the past, this is how God communicated with his people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? A lot of different times. A lot of different ways. He wasn't limited. It wasn't just a one-time thing where God said, here it is. It did it a lot of times. What's the significance of the many times part, by the way?
Patience.
God is patient.
Do what? God is patient.
He's patient, and so therefore he did what? He kept telling them over and over and over, you see, because they just... oftentimes just wouldn't listen. But God kept telling, sending more prophets and so forth. Okay? Brian?
And his people dictated how they wanted to be communicated because they're the ones requesting the king.
Yeah.
Everybody else got kings. We want kings.
Yeah.
So he talked to them to do that as well.
Yeah.
Okay. He says, all right, I'll give you every avenue.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different times and a lot of different ways that God communicated to his people under the Old Testament times. Okay? But in these last days, which refers to what?
Christ's time?
Yeah, this period right now,
yeah,
the
right.
Christian age.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Just if you're taking notes and you maybe want to make a note of this, there are how many different ages when it comes to biblical history time? How many different ages or dispensations are there?
Three.
There's three. Okay, what are they?
Patriarchal.
The patriarchal age, which was, as we mentioned earlier, when God spoke directly to the fathers. Okay, then there is the Mosaic age, which is the law. Okay, it takes us all the way up to the time of Christ. Okay, and the third era is the Christian age. So one of the things that's significant to note about that, if you haven't already, is at the end of this age, what's the next age going to be?
Eternity.
Eternity. There is no more age in terms of, you know, history of this world after the Christian age. Okay, so in the past, referring to, again, what ages? The patriarchal age and the Mosaic age. In the past, God spoke in many times through the prophets in many times in many ways. But in these last days, So that encompasses from the time of Christ to now, okay? Until he comes back again. That is the Christian age, and that is what is referred to as the last days, and it's because there will not be any other days. Usually when something is last, that means what? There's nothing else after that. If you're last in line, right? Okay? That means there's nobody behind you. Okay? And so when these are the last days, that means there's no more days coming. Okay? There's not another age or dispensation. So, in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. Okay? The way that God has communicated to us today is by his Son. Okay? Turn over to John chapter 1. You're going to hear this again later on this morning, but go over to John chapter 1. Beginning in verse 1. Help me out here. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, right? He, that is who? Jesus, the Word, was with God in the beginning. All right? What is the significance of that statement to what the writer here in Hebrews is telling us here? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. What is he telling us here?
They're one and the same.
Do what?
They're one and the same.
They're one and the same, but what's one and the same?
Jesus and God.
Jesus and
God the Father.
Yeah, but
the Word.
You see, John's emphasis in that statement is basically, God has a message for his people, for his creation. Okay? And he's delivering that message
through Christ.
Through his Son, the Word. Okay? Verse 14. What does it say there?
The Word became
flesh and dwelt amongst us, right? Literally means he pitched his tent here. Okay? The Word. Okay? Again, understand the significance of that in that writing, that he's telling us basically the message from God. Okay? All right? Is Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
All right? You want to know what God's Word is? Listen to what Jesus has to say. Okay? Because he is... It doesn't just say that he has the Word. Okay? He what? He is the Word. Thank you. Okay? He is the Word. And so you want to know, how does God speak to his people today? Through the Word. What Word? Jesus. Which is this. That's what he gave us.
It's Jesus. I mean, God didn't speak through Jesus only in the New Testament, did he?
Oh, no.
He also in the Old Testament, because when creation was, let us make, okay?
Right.
And John also tells us that through him all things were
right.
made that were made.
Right.
So it's through God, through Jesus,
right.
that you hear the Word of God, whether it be... When he speaks to even to, for example, Abraham,
right?
That was Jesus speaking with him.
It was
okay. So, but you know what? I find that a lot of Christians don't understand that part.
Right? They don't.
It's
and yes, it's true that we look at several of the times that God spoke. Okay, to you know people in Old Testament, Abraham, Moses, he spoke to him in the form of a burning bush.
Yeah.
That was likely Christ.
Yeah.
Okay? All right? But for the purpose of this book here, this letter, what the writer wants us to understand is to emphasize that that was the old way that God spoke and dealt with his people. There is a new way now, and that new way is his son. Ryan?
Throughout the Old Testament, he even told it in a parable. Throughout the Old Testament, he told them this is the way it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I sent messengers to tell you, mm-hmm. they will not listen. I sent my son, and you crucify him.
Yeah.
And he told him, I'm trying to create that relationship again right. that you lost and messed up in the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. And this is how I'm going to do it. But to this day, people don't accept that.
Right. Okay. Now, I want to make sure we cover this before we run out of time here. What is the primary implication of this statement that the writer is making here about the last days? What is the primary thing that we need to make sure we understand that he's trying to tell us here? It is implied here. Anybody have any idea?
There
isn't going to be any other messenger. Okay? This is it, folks. Okay? There's no other messenger. There ain't anybody else going to come along later on. In other words, if you don't listen to this one, okay, then as the saying goes, you stand a snowball's chance. You know where I'm going with that, right? Okay? Because that's the alternative. If you don't accept the Son, there's nothing else coming. And he's going to talk more about that later on when he talks about no sacrifice for sin is left if we keep on sinning, you see. If we don't accept Christ, there isn't anything else. There's no Buddha, there's no Muhammad, there's no nothing. There's no Joseph Smith. There isn't another messenger that God has sent or is going to send to communicate with his people. Okay? Jesus declared himself, all right, when the disciples said, Lord, we don't know where you're going, how can we know the way? What did he say?
I am the way,
the truth, and the life. And what? No one comes to the Father except by me. There is no other messenger. Okay? In these last days, the message is coming from his Son. And there will be no other. Okay? So we need to understand, you either accept Christ or you're lost. There's no alternative to that. God isn't going to send another person, another, you know, prophet or whatever else at some other time. It's not going to happen. Because the next event in terms of biblical history that the world is going to see is what?
It's coming.
The coming of Christ. Okay? And when that happens, then these last days will be over. Thank you. Wesley, are you off next week? Do you know?
Well, I don't know.
Okay, as far as he knows, Wesley is off. He's going to be planning to teach Bible class next week. And I'm not sure where you're going to go, but we will pick up with this as we the following week. All right? Thank you all very, very much.